look at Israel from hundreds of miles up in space, Israel is of no consequence. Just a little tiny sliver of land, but a land through which one must go when traveling the so-called Fertile Crescent, right here. It is more than 300 miles from Mount Hermon in the north to Eilat in the south. But it is, however, a very narrow country. We're going to start the review of what happened there at the end of April at Masada. Masada was a mountain fortress originally constructed by King Herod, but later taken over by Jewish zealots in 67 AD. These are the storehouses up here. This is the bathhouse, and you're going to see that a little bit later. And there are the remains of the northern palace, which was the place that was cool, and that's where the king loved to go. Now, you can see the Dead Sea in the distance. Here's Masada, and here's the Dead Sea. The top of Masada is roughly at sea level. And so you can see that 1,200 feet down, you go to the lowest place on Earth, the Dead Sea. The Romans built an enormous access ramp to break into the fortress. But the rebels killed themselves when it was clear that the Romans would prevail. Some of the brethren actually walked this ramp to get to the top. And there were others of us who preferred the cable car on the other side. This is one of the most extensively restored buildings. They had plenty of water here, thanks to an enormous cistern system. Heated water passed under the floor and between these posts essentially made a steam room out of it. There were two outside walls here, that were there for added protection. And the zealots actually constructed some walls here between them to make extra rooms. This hole here was used to quarry stone. What's interesting is this black line, and you see it in a lot of different places. The black line was done by the archaeologists, and they drew it to show you that everything that was above the line was reconstructed. It's their best guess. Everything below the line was found there, so that there was no guessing. It shows intellectual honesty. Masada is the most thoroughly reconstructed archaeological work in Israel. Now that you've seen it and you look at it, you can have, I suppose, either of two reactions. The first is, it's an incredible job to take rubble like this and make something of it. That's reaction number one. Reaction number two is, doesn't look that great. If I were king, I think I'd like to live in something better than this. Now, in case you just happen to have reaction number two, don't worry. This is just about all the archaeological restoration you have to look at. After Masada, we went down to the Dead Sea, the lowest place on Earth. You can't sink in the Dead Sea because the water is more than 10 times the salt content compared to the ocean. Now, because of the increased atmospheric pressure, you've got 1,200 extra feet, there is 15% more oxygen here than in the air over the Mediterranean Sea. The Dead Sea has been shrinking in size during the last few years, perhaps because Israel is using as much of the water from the Jordan River as it can. North of this area is the area of Qumran, where a shepherd boy in 1947 found the first of what came to be called the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here is one of the caves high up in the mountain. Here's another case. After the initial find of these first scrolls, a concentrated search was made for other scrolls, and they found them. Hundreds more were found. The scrolls had been wrapped in linen and placed in carefully sealed jars, like these. Now, I want you to pay attention to the design of the top of the jar, because it was that design that was copied when they made the museum that contains some of the Dead Sea Scrolls that are on display. Water is being sprayed on the exterior of it to keep it cool inside. And of course, inside, there are fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls that are on display. They are written in Hebrew and in Aramaic, and are about 1,000 years older than the oldest manuscripts they had in 1947. So you can see what a tremendous find this was. Here's an example of what it looks like. This is a fragment from the book of Isaiah. That book was found in its entirety. They also found portions of every Old Testament book with one exception. They found nothing from the book of Esther. Imagine wandering in a place like this for 40 years. There are stones everywhere. You can understand why execution by stoning was the execution method of choice. You didn't have to search very far for a weapon. Most of the enjoyment of a trip like this comes from the expertise of the bus guide. All of the guides are good, and all are tested and licensed by the state of Israel. I'm going to give you a 45-second excerpt from our guide, Zach. And under the best of circumstances, it's hard to catch it, but here goes.
Well, as you know, they say Moses, his compass was off, he should have turned right instead of turning left. Right? We could do with the oil too, or well too. This is the land of milk and honey, but that's all we got. We got lots of milk and honey, that's our end. In other words, and as you know, to build a country without some kind of proper natural resources is difficult. We have to import and export. We export tourist services. We import, for example, whether it be diamonds, uncut diamonds, and we export the diamonds as our biggest industry, or other things. But really, without tourism, then no one's even going to buy that stuff. So right. Tourism is in the full sense of the word, a lifeblood of the country. We live from it here, and it's a direct blessing to the country.
I love that. Moses' compass was off. You know, if he turned right, they would have had all the oil. But he didn't. He turned left, and all they got was milk and honey. But he made another point that was really good, and that is that under very difficult conditions, it builds strong people. And it's been said about the United States, if the pilgrims had landed in Florida, there never would have been a United States of America. But they landed in Massachusetts, and half of them died at the end of the first year. And we're able then to build that strong people that built the country. This is the Jordan River. And it seems to me that river is a little strong to use in describing it. You might say the Jordan Creek. You might say the Lake of Galilee. But water is so important to Israel that these terms reflect how important this water is to them. Rowena Greenhall from Australia, she's here at the convention, had recently made a consecration and asked if she could be immersed in the River Jordan. And so arrangements were made for a brief talk and for the immersion service. Brother Lee Hicks from San Luis Obispo and a sister from England joined Rowena, and the three were immersed in the Jordan. And undoubtedly, when you ask about what the highlight of the convention was to these three, you know what they would answer. This was a fairly long, strenuous trek up the mountain of the Beatitudes. And with the brethren strung out along the path, you can almost picture the crowds that were following Jesus whenever he came to their local area. There's a gradual slope from the top in three directions, but in this one, it is a sheer drop, and the Sea of Galilee can be seen in the distance. Now, this part of Israel looks very different than it does in the south. There's water here, and that means you can grow crops. Israel is self-sufficient in food, and in fact, agricultural exports is their second biggest moneymaker. First is the export of cut diamonds, and the third is tourism. This is the area called the Banias. It's one of three springs that feed into the Jordan. In Roman times, this area was called Caesarea Philippi. Isaiah 35, in the wilderness shall waters break out and springs of water in a thirsty land. Thirsty land aptly characterizes the land of Israel. Israel wants peace with her neighbors, but as you can see from this armed border with Lebanon, there is only a state of tension. Mount Hermon marks the northern boundary of Israel. I asked, is this Mount Hermon, or is this Mount Hermon? And the answer was yes. This is one of Israel's ports on the Mediterranean Sea. In another port, we see fishermen still plying their trade using nets, as they did in the old days. This is the ruins of a Roman theater at Caesarea. You can always tell where the Romans went. They loved the arch, and they used it extensively for their building project. This is an ancient aqueduct. This is where water came, sort of like what we did in California, where we bring water from where we have it down to where we don't. And that's what the Romans did here. They were bringing water to their settlement. They were known for building long aqueducts wherever they went. These are the Bell Caves. These caves originally contained a deposit of chalk, and that was valuable to make plaster. Now, originally, it was all solid, and they mined it by digging down from the top. And as they began to dig, they would sort of fan out, digging from the top, and eventually these caverns, shaped roughly like bells, were created. I've never seen anything like that anywhere else. Now, a trip to the Holy Land would never be complete unless you got a short ride on a camel. But watch out when the camel gets up. It stands first on its back feet, which of course pitches the rider forward and generally creates the impression that this is the last camel ride that one wants to take. Wherever there is a supposed holy site, there is a church. This is the Church of the Annunciation that you see here. And it commemorates the announcement of the angel to Mary that she would be the mother of Jesus. It's the fifth building that has appeared on this site. It was completed in 1969. Notice that I said commemorated, and our guide used that word a lot. Don't think this is the site where. Think this is a site that commemorates or brings to our memory whatever it was that it was built for. Here's the Church of the Nativity. And that church is down here. And it remembers the birth of Jesus in this little town of Bethlehem. The remains of many stone mangers have been found. This is one, a stone manger. Now, of course, at Christmas time, we always see pictures of wooden mangers. But if you see the stone and you think about straw being placed in it, it actually would be a very convenient place to lay a newborn babe. And being with animals meant that there would be added warmth. Now, although there's controversy about exactly where something happened, you see out in the outskirts of Bethlehem, shepherds still tending their sheep and their goats on the surrounding hillside, just as they did 2,000 years ago when angels announced the birth of the world Savior. Now, there was a store in Bethlehem that collected old olive wood trunks and trees. This is all olive wood that had been cut. And this is the store bin, and it sits there to be suitably aged. Now, you think about this. This is not attractive, which is sort of like the way we are when first touched by the Lord. But when touched by a true artisan, this old olive wood can be turned into objects of real beauty. And you have to admire the skill of the artist who takes such dry wood and creates this wonderful art. Now here's an Arab village. Each house in Israel has a solar heater. These are solar panels and it heats water. And this is on the roof, and the building code demands it. It is not optional. Israel is a leader in drip irrigation. You can see these rubber pipes that are bringing just the right amount of water to the trees and shrubs. But with California now doing the low flush toilets in the building code, it was amazing to me that Israel doesn't have low flush toilets. But they are delivering the water to the trees and the shrubs in exactly the right amount. I have the suspicion that these other ways of saving water will soon be instituted. Of course, the reason that so many brethren were in Israel was the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to attend a convention of Bible students in Israel, with the whole theme of the convention being Israel. We hear about, well, the theme of this convention was, fill in the blank. Well, yes, but not like this. This was a convention that knew what its theme was, and all of the presentations supported that theme. All sessions were held in the large meeting room in the Sheraton Hotel there in Jerusalem. Now, all of the sessions, in fact, all of the testimonies were in English. But in addition to the English-speaking brethren, there were brethren who spoke German, Polish, and French. And as at the international conventions, simultaneous translations were provided in all of these languages, even when we were out on tour walking around. These, for example, were the French brethren. Now, there were brethren on the program from non-English-speaking countries, but everyone who spoke from the platform spoke in English. Now, there were 290 registered attendees, and these are the language groups that they divided themselves up into. More than 25% of the brethren who were at this convention did not have English as their native language. Now, the next few pictures are of all the Bible students that we know about who currently live in Israel. This is Stuart Livermore. Stuart cannot speak, but he carries a kind of computer that helps him communicate. And at one of the sessions, Stuart conducted the singing, and it brought me back in memory to general conventions long ago when Stuart led the singing. And his style is so unique that you remember it, and it hasn't changed a bit. This is Connie Campbell. Connie is the widow of Jack Campbell. And Jack Campbell, an archaeologist, had been selected by the committee to give the convention's welcoming address. He wrote the address, submitted it, and shortly after it, he died. And his prepared remarks were read to the convention by another. Jack was in charge of the early excavations that took place at Masada. Some here know Arden and Darlene Bausch. The Bausches moved to Israel 20 years ago, and they changed their first names to Hebrew names. They're now Lev and Hava. And I heard just recently that Lev and Hava now have their permanent residency permits to live in Israel. Another Bible student that we know about is Brother Bessinger. That's Brother Bessinger here. He's 93 years old. He speaks German and Hebrew only. He studied Brother Russell's volumes. He has had the truth for 70 years. Now, he had the opportunity to buy land years ago, and he established a kibbutz on that land. and since has had numerous opportunities to witness about the coming Messiah to those that come to that kibbutz. Many of the Poles that were at the convention knew Brother Eliezer Malachi, because he had done some work on the Polish retirement center and then seemingly disappeared. They did not realize that he had immigrated to Israel until they saw him there. When he first arrived in Israel, he spent a month with Brother Bessinger. Now, we all received a book containing all of the presentations. The book was also provided in the other languages. The beauty of the book was enhanced by an extensive number of sketches that were done by Shirley Bickle Evans. Now, there was more than just the presentations. The back of the book contained an extensive collection of information about where we were and what we would be seeing. Now, the highlight of the convention for many of us was the services that were held the afternoon of the very first day at the Garden Tomb just outside the Damascus Gate. This man, who's speaking, explained the evidence that supports the assertion that this was the tomb in which Jesus was laid after he was dead. The evidence? Well, the tomb clearly belonged to a rich man. It was hewn out of rock, and it was in a garden. It was outside the city walls. It was big enough for several people to stand within it. And the archaeologists confirmed that it was indeed a tomb from the Herodian period. Oh, yes. The tomb was empty when it was excavated. Two of our brethren each spoke for 30 minutes on a resurrection theme, and 30-minute discourses was the standard length for this convention. This is the tomb itself, right here. Notice this track that's right here in front of the tomb. Now, you've heard about rolling away the stone, and I don't know what kind of mental image you have, but I want you to think about a phonograph record. A phonograph record that fits in this groove would roll in this groove back, and if it's big enough, it would roll and cover the entrance to the tomb. So rolling away the stone means rolling it up the tracks. There was ample time after the service for all the friends to actually enter the tomb and to look around. I think most of us came away with convinced that this was far more likely to be the actual tomb than the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, a 4th century church that was built by Constantine, commemorating, evidently, what others believe to be the site. Christians in England bought this site in 1894. They had many reasons for doing so, but one of their big ones was to keep a church from being erected above it. And they certainly have preserved the dignity of this site. The garden and its paths preserve a real feeling of reverence, and gardens are rare in Jerusalem. Immediately outside the garden is a place that some say was Golgotha, the place of the skull. You can sort of, if you have an imagination, see the skull, you know, the eyes. And it's like ink blocks. Once you're told what to see, you can see it. The thing that goes through my mind, did it look like this 2,000 years ago? You know, I'm not so sure. And it could be called the place of the skull for many reasons. It is kind of, now this is controversial. I'll try to point out the controversial things. It was quite possible, it's been suggested, that Abraham expected to slay Isaac on this identical site, not at the rock covered by the dome on top of the Temple Mount, which we will see later. And that's what tradition suggests. And if that's true, and if this is Golgotha, it would more accurately typify the offering of Jesus by his Father at an identical place centuries later. At the end of the next afternoon, the entire convention again left the Sheraton, and this time to go to the Hebrew University, which you see right there at the top of the hill. Now, this Hebrew University received its name because when it was founded earlier in this century, They decided that all the teaching would be done in the Hebrew language. Now, that sounds obvious today, but it wasn't then. German was the accepted language for higher learning. But they said, no, here it's going to be Hebrew, and it's called the Hebrew University. Here's part of the view from the site of the Hebrew University. Let's see what we have here. We have a square tower. It's a hospital. We have arches here. The arches belong to the Mormon University. The Mormons are there in Israel. The pointed tower that you see here is the Church of the Ascension, and that church is a Muslim church. It's maybe surprising to you that the Mormons are there, and they were permitted by the government to have a presence in Israel if they agreed that they would do absolutely no proselytizing. And they don't. People who come to the university and ask religious-oriented questions are told that they are to write to the Mormon headquarters in Salt Lake City. Hebrew University is beautiful. Although it is in a dry, desert-like environment, its grass, its flowers, its shrubs are lush. This Hebrew University research building was dedicated to President Harry S. Truman because of all that Truman did to make possible the establishment of the State of Israel. It was Truman who, speaking for the United States, immediately recognized Israel when they became a nation. Here in the amphitheater of the university, you can see the Judean wilderness in the background, and if it were a really clear day, you could even see the Dead Sea. I mean, you look at a place like this and you say, perfect place for the convention photo. And you're right. The obligatory group photo was taken here on the steps of the Hebrew University Amphitheater. We had presentations from people who were not Bible students, and that happened here in the amphitheater. A recent Russian immigrant, now on the faculty of the Hebrew University, spoke briefly to us. It was emotionally wrenching to hear how difficult it was for them under the old Russian regime. And I want to play the last 20 seconds of what she said.
Right here gives many opportunities to the people who come here and who are motivated to come to their motherland. I don't like high words, but I tell you that now I know what it is to live in your own land and in a free country. Thank you.
We had dinner at the Hebrew University, and after dinner, Mr. Moshe Sasson, Israel's first ambassador to Egypt, spoke to the group about his experiences and the many, many difficulties on the road to peace. My impression is that having outside speakers at a place like this was extremely stimulating. On another day, we heard from Professor Kaufman, and he talked about his research on the location of the Second Temple. He was a compelling speaker. He said that the Second Temple apparently was constructed with a cubit equal to about 17 inches. That's a debated point from time to time by the experts. We heard from Rabbi Yitzhak Rubin, who gave us a perspective on Jewish thought. He told us that devout Jews do not simply believe that God exists. That's easy. But they believe in God, that God cares, that God can take us out of whatever Egypt condition that we may be in, just as he took his people out of a literal Egypt so many years ago. After his prepared remarks, the rabbi conducted a long question and answer session and was extremely articulate. And his first question, which actually was a question that I had in my mind, was, why do devout Jews wear this little cap on the top of their heads? This is what he said.
Our concept is that A person can easily forget because he's out of health. And therefore, when a person covers his head with a little cap, is to remember that the presence of God is always involved. So that's the meaning of that.
It reminds the wearer that there is something higher, the presence of God, and that wearing of the little cap is the constant reminder to them of the presence of God, something higher above them. At the end of the convention, we toured the city of Jerusalem. We were divided among many buses so that we would not descend on the same site at the same time. And of course, that meant we had lots to talk about at night because we weren't at the same places at the same time. Here we are at Gethsemane. Gethsemane is from the Hebrew Gat Shemen and means olive press. The Garden of Gethsemane is near the top of the Mount of Olives, and it's opposite the city of Jerusalem. Today it is a very small but lovely garden. These are some of the oldest olive trees in Israel. Some, it is suggested, may be over 1,000 years old. We were told that when you cut down an olive tree, it grows up again, and thus makes an excellent symbol for rejuvenation and resurrection. The original root stock of some of these trees could conceivably date back to the time of our Lord. This is the panoramic view of Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives. Now, we have the Temple Mount, of course. That's what you'll always see. And, of course, you have the dome. And that dome is called the Dome of the Rock. And you have the Golden Gate, which is now all walled up. And, of course, all filled with graves along this valley, the Kidron Valley. And it reminds us of Psalm 122. Our feet shall stand within the gates, O Jerusalem, built as a city that is compacted together. Well, in the old days, Jerusalem was considerably more compact than it is today. Today, all the growth and the building is going on outside the walls, but in 1000 BC, under David, it was just a little bit of land there. About, they suggest, 10 acres on Mount Zion. And that's a place where the Dormition Abbey stands today. Now, this section around the wall has all been newly excavated. Note, high up on the western wall of the Temple Mount, this little bit of stone. You see, there's a little bit of stone just jutting out. And that was enough proof to the archaeologists that it was an anchor for an arch. And the artist's reconstruction of this, which you see there, shows it as the support for steps to allow access to the Temple Mount. These steps on the south side, which are over here, were also uncovered in the excavation. Now, this is a model of Jerusalem in Jesus' times that you can see, and we did see it. And this is a time when the city contained perhaps, 100,000 people. Today it has five times that number. And again, you can see in this picture the arch and the steps. The steps were made of varying widths so that it would not be easy to move up those steps quickly. Solemnity was expected when you approached the temple. Now, from these steps, one looks east to the Mount of Olives. Now, these were the homes of the poor people in Jesus' time, from the model. And this is the western wall of the Temple Mount, and it was never destroyed. Before Israel took control of Jerusalem in the 1967 war, this wall was called the Wailing Wall. And here it is. Jews still worship at this wall. The men on the left, the women on the right. And these were the original stones from the time of Herod. They are so massive, they couldn't be destroyed. And in the background, the Dome of the Rock. Saudi Arabia is paying to replace the roof of the dome with gold. This is the third most sacred place to the Muslims, third after Mecca and Medina. The mosque took 7 years to build. It was completed in 691 AD. Islam permits mosaics to contain calligraphy or geometric patterns, but no images or pictures of anything. And this is the rock under the dome. And it's the traditional site where Abraham offered Isaac and where Muhammad ascended to heaven. Here's the inside of a mosque. It's the mosque that's opposite the Dome of the Rock. Now, you don't see pews. You see prayer rugs, and that's for the faithful. Bare legs are not permitted on the Temple Mount. Now, some may have a problem with that, and they are loaned something to correct the problem. But shoes are definitely not permitted when entering the mosques. Now, this spot right here is Professor Kaufman's guess as to where the Second Temple's Holy of Holies was located. He says the height of the bedrock here is exactly correct. Today, no devout Jew will walk on the Temple Mount because he fears that he might inadvertently tread on the place where the Most Holy was located. This is St. Anne's Church, built where tradition says the birth of Mary occurred. That one is a little tough for me. It was completed in 1142 and thus is older than the Notre Dame in Paris. The acoustics in this church are absolutely wonderful. In John 19:13, it says, Pilate sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement. Now, the Greek word is lithostatos. This is the lithostatos. These paving stones, well below street level, we've got 2,000 years of debris, date to Pilate's time. And it's entirely possible that the scourging of our Lord occurred at or near here. And there are marks in these stones that were made by soldiers that were playing dice games. This synagogue was originally built in 1740, built on top of a 13th century synagogue, and it was blown up in 1948 by the Jordanians. The arch was reconstructed as a memorial. This synagogue was one of the last pockets of resistance before the area fell in 1948, and it's been left this way as a memorial. Interesting to walk around Jerusalem. Here in the corner, a partial Roman column left here, just where it was found, uncovered, when this courtyard was constructed, and thus we can see what was here. Here's a typical street in the Jewish quarter. Now, we were told that as far as their culture is concerned, Arabs don't care how the outside of their home appears because it's the inside that's important. You know you're not in the Arab quarter. It's very important how things appear to the Jews, and it is reflected in their architecture. Whenever they dig in Jerusalem, they find something. This is the remains of a wall. You can see how wide it is, that dates back to Old Testament times. It would be necessary to give those that lived within it an adequate defense. The Jews revere their past. They go to great pains to preserve it, to exhibit it. Now, you see young soldiers everywhere. They carry their guns with them. Why do they do that? Well, a soldier without his gun is not worth very much. And I actually found the sight reassuring. Pretty much as one might feel about police officers that you know are dedicated to keeping the peace. All young men must serve 3 years in the army. All young women must serve 2 years. And part of their military education is the indoctrination in their heritage. And so you see them at many of the same places that are frequented by tourists. This is the Zion Gate. It's so called because the gate faces Mount Zion. It's one of seven gates into Jerusalem. Now, Jordan held the territory on the other side of this wall until Jerusalem became unified in the 1967 war. What's interesting is this. These holes are all made by bullets. Bullets that were fired during that war. Here's a model of how Jerusalem looked in Jesus' time. This is the area where the wealthy lived. The Temple Mount is in the background, and the Romans built the Antonio Fortress, that's right here, a little bit taller, so they could look down and see what was going on in the temple court. This complex, which is found at the Jaffa Gate, is a fortress first built 2 centuries before Christ. We're talking about this area right here. Although Jerusalem was completely destroyed by Titus in 70 AD, some of this fortress survived because it was being used by the Romans. And Israel has done a partial reconstruction. In fact, it now houses the Museum of the History of Jerusalem. This tower, right here, is called the Tower of David. Well, it was called that by 19th century travelers, even though this is a really inaccurate term. It's a minaret. It's used to call the faithful Muslims to prayer. It was built in 1335 by the Ottomans. It has nothing to do with David, but it is called the Tower of David. And in this museum and in this area, there is a biblical herb garden. And I thought that I knew my herbs, but I saw something growing in the back wall, and I was surprised when I read the plate. This herb is wormwood, and I never associated that name with herbs. Within this museum, at this location, is a zinc model of how Jerusalem looked in the mid-19th century. The artist essentially copied the city with his model, much as a photographer would copy it with film. It was constructed on the scale of 1 to 500. I mean, if it's 500 feet long, then it's 1 foot long in the model. It was first displayed at the Vienna International Fair in 1872 and is now on permanent display here. Now, there are also numerous models of what a proposed third temple might look like. And at the convention, there arose a new controversial question that beautifully seemed to divide the brethren into two camps. And that question is, will a third temple, following the dimensions we find in Ezekiel, ever be built in Jerusalem or not? I would suggest that if this question comes up in your presence, that you tread a little lightly in your answer, because emotions seemed to run very high on both sides of this question. Now, one can walk on the top of the wall around nearly all of the Jerusalem that was contained within it. Now, no trip to Jerusalem is complete unless you walk the narrow streets of the bazaar. Bargaining, of course, is obligatory, no matter how demeaning it might be. Let's hear the bazaar.
Come on.
$200?
$5.
Listen, believe me. What are you looking
for? I know.
Okay, listen to me. Give me $7.
$6. Okay, I want to see you want to take it. Open your hand.
I want $5.
$200.
$6, man. Six.
How much, sir?
100.
It's 20 in each one?
Yeah. $6, you want or no?
How many?
25, tiny.
25?
Yes, tiny.
$20.
Believe me, open to speak.
He didn't buy. Really funny. It's all just going on around me. You can't possibly drink enough liquid in Israel. It is so dry, the moisture just leaves your body through the skin. It is said that the Israelis are 9 times more likely to have kidney stones than Americans because they don't drink enough liquid. Well, in my opinion, you can't ever drink enough liquid. Now, of course, you don't have to drink water, You can drink Diet Coke. Here are oregano pizzas. If you had told me that before I ate it, I probably wouldn't have tried it. They are cheap, they are delicious. Freshly baked bread, sold on the street. Now, our last stop in this report is the Holocaust Museum. It's called Yad Vashem. It consists of several buildings. This is one of them. There is in this building an eternal flame that burns over a floor listing the major Nazi concentration camps. The name of a camp is larger or smaller, depending on the number who died in that camp. This is the Street of the Faithful Gentiles. Each tree has a plaque that commemorates Gentiles who helped the Jews during the Holocaust. Here's an example. A plaque for the people of Denmark. When the Nazis decreed that the Jews had to wear an identifying armband, the King of Denmark put one on. And immediately, all the Danes did the same thing, defeating the decree. Man with a gun here at the Holocaust Museum. No one can have a gun in Israel unless they are licensed to have it. It is openly displayed in Los Angeles. Anyone can have a gun, and it is rarely displayed. I think I prefer the Israeli system. This is our last stop. It's the Children's Museum here at Yad Vashem. The parents of a child who perished in the Auschwitz concentration camp provided this memorial for the 1.5 million children who perished in the camps. Now, America lost 50,000 people in the Vietnam War. And they wrote their names on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. You would have to erect 30 such walls to contain all the names of just the children who perished. The entrance is bright, it's white, it's cheerful. But inside, all of that changes. The light of just a few candles is endlessly multiplied by the mirrors. You can hardly see. Two voices speak the name, the age, the city of a child who died. The languages that are being spoken change in a random pattern. Let's go inside. Recent survey, Time magazine reported that 22% of the American adults said that, yes, it seems possible that the Holocaust never happened. 22%. Such a denial in the face of incontrovertible fact shows why memorials are necessary. With the passage of time, people forget, or they simply refuse to accept what they don't want to believe. 100 years ago, Brother Russell taught that the scripture showed that Israel would have a special place in the kingdom. Chart of the Ages, published in the first volume, puts Israel above the world of mankind in the kingdom. But that was 100 years ago, and some forget. Sometimes I think 22% of today's Bible students might say that it seems possible that Israel will have no special place in the kingdom. People forget. Or perhaps they have their reasons for not accepting what they don't want to believe. God did not regather this nation to do nothing with them. Those of us who were in Israel came away impressed with what has happened there. And brethren, it is just the beginning. Isaiah 66. Rejoice ye with Jerusalem. Be glad with her, all ye that love her. For thus saith the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the nations like a flowing stream. Amen.
For those of us who are there, it's a wonderful reminder of the blessings of our trip there. And for those of you who were not there, I hope this gives you a little bit of the flavor of our visit. And perhaps if the opportunity presents itself, it'll act as a little stimulant to join others in a journey to Jerusalem and the land of Israel. We have a few announcements. We're going to ask Brother Michael to ask you to stand, because we're going to ask you to sit again for a little while. So let's all stand. We'll ask Brother Michael to dismiss this meeting and then quietly be seated again.
Our dear Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy most holy name. We as thy children come to thee in prayer at this time to thank thee for all the goodness and all the mercy that thou hast bestowed upon us. We thank thee for calling us out of darkness into thy marvelous light of truth and understanding. And we thank thee too for the lessons that we see written in the scriptures about the chosen people Israel, and the things that we have seen still there engraved on the rocks. We indeed pray that the lessons that are there, the things that have happened, will stand as an example and lesson for us, that we would not fall into the same unbelief as our life grows longer in this narrow way. Help us to be faithful, even unto death, that we might have a share in thy coming kingdom in bringing the entire world of mankind back to perfect human life right here on earth. We would remember in prayer those that have special needs, the sick, the isolated, the afflicted. May they feel thy presence near in their time of need. And it indeed is our prayer that thou would continue to be with us, to lead, guide, and direct us, and to specially bless the remainder of this convention. For we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.